Dit is New Business Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Water Talks on New Business Radio, a podcast and radio special inspiring the Dutch water sector and business professionals around the globe. Today, we're talking about water from a risk perspective. Ambika, you're global project lead at the Valuing Water Initiative of the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The most obvious question, what do you do exactly?
It is obvious, isn't it? Thanks. I think the Valuing Water Initiative that you just mentioned came into being in 2018 or so, when actually 11 heads of state signed to the UN release of the Valuing Water Principles. So that was really 11 heads of state who came together and said, valuing water is important. We all commit to try to do it. The Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, was one of the heads of state who actually signed these principles. And he then questioned and said, well, you know, we have five principles that are beautifully written out, but what does this mean? What does it mean we need to change? What should we be actually doing with it? So, you know, the principles are very, very, very sound and very encompassing. But they obviously, it's a set of principles that doesn't tell you how you should actually be implementing it. So, for example, one that says recognize and embrace water's multiple values, or one that says reconcile values and build trust. Now, these are all very nice words, but what do you do with it in real life?
Yeah, what does it mean?
So one of the what does it mean? You know, and how do you actually, if you want to do this in your real life, how do you do it? So the initiative has been set up with the objective to sort of operationalize these principles. We say that our motto is that we want to have better decisions that impact water. And when I say better decisions that impact water, I mean not just decisions taken by water authorities, you know, how much water goes where, et cetera. It's also about every decision that indirectly may impact water. So you're focusing on finance today. Every decision that an investor or a banker makes has an impact on water when they decide who to finance, how to finance. We need to understand how those decisions can be better, how they can actually work. We understand that decisions are choices. They are trade-offs. People are not choosing to ignore water for the fun of it. They have something else that they're prioritizing. What is it that they're prioritizing? How is it that water can play into what it is that they're trying to achieve? You know, and those are the type of things that you need to understand. We look at systemic change. That's one of our objectives. Preetha mentioned a little bit earlier that we have the, you know, the technocratic way of doing things, which is the integrated water management, but that still remains water management. Often the challenges with water have absolutely nothing to do with water. So if you look at, we had a case in Colombia, which the Dutch ministry has financed, where we were trying to get coffee farmers in Colombia to value water better. And we did everything we could to, you know, give them the tools, give them filters, give them machinery, education, training. But last year, I think they made, coffee farmers in Colombia made the lowest amount per day that they have ever made. So their salaries were lowest ever. Now, when you don't have money to meet your basic needs, you're not going to be valuing water. You don't have the luxury to do anything about that. So if I keep on trying to enter this conversation from a water point of view, if that's my entry point and that's my focus, I am not going to be able to solve this. Systemically, I have not understood what enables the devaluing of water, what makes it impossible to value water in this situation. So that's sort of what we're trying to do. Think of a game of Monopoly. If the only way to win Monopoly is to bankrupt everybody else, then that's what everybody is going to keep doing. You can play it in how many of rounds you like. You can give somebody a little bit of extra cash. You can, you know, be a little bit nice and not keep somebody in jail for very long. But at the end of the day, the only way to win Monopoly is to make everybody else lose. So unless you change, and first of all, you need to understand the rules of the game. You need to understand what rewards you're giving for people to play it that way. And unless you change those levers, you're not going to get the systemic change you're looking for. So that's sort of what the initiative is doing. It's a very complex process. We are trying to understand what the trade-offs and choices are for different groups, whether they are financiers. We are also working with the youth. We are also working in certain regions, like in Peru, in Colombia, I just mentioned, Ethiopia. Yeah. We're trying to understand why these systemic problems don't seem to go away and how we can actually address them by doing things differently, by understanding what levers of change need to be pressed so that we can get the outcomes that we're looking for.
Ambika, the fifth valuing water principle is invest and innovate. What's the importance of specifically that one?
Yeah, so, you know, without money, it's very difficult to do many things. Invest and innovate is really about that. It's about understanding that the whole burden of water does not fall onto the government sector, which is what typically happens, is that it's considered a public good, it's considered a public utility, and therefore the private sector bears no burden of the costs that it takes to protect water and value water. So invest and innovate really touches upon the fact, Preetha was talking about a little bit earlier, what FMO was trying to do, you know, try to really crowd in the private sector. How do you make this more appealing for different types of financiers? There's a lot of money in the world. It's going towards things that are not water secure. How do we move all that investment into water secure behavior, whether that's from corporates, investors, banks, whatever so it may be. So with invest and innovate, one of the things that we are looking at, and we're working with Robin's team at Ceres on this, is how do we mobilize some of the world's largest investors in moving their investments to water secure behavior. Now, you can keep trying to ask corporates to do things, but one of the very powerful levers of change would be if their investors told them, we will not invest in you unless you actually become more water secure. That is a really big pressure point that would get in corporates to act differently.
Yeah, is that realistic, Robin?
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing this happen right now in the climate movement. So there's a whole initiative called the Climate Action 100 Plus, and Ceres is a key partner in that group, along with a few other global institutional investor initiatives, where we're working collaboratively with some of the largest institutional investors in the world to ask companies to align with the Paris Agreement. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that this work being supported with Amica's team will be, you know, somewhat analogous to that type of initiative. Now, it's going to take a lot of work to get there, and we're at some of the early exciting stages. But yeah, I certainly think that we can get there, and it will take partnership. It will take thinking beyond water being an isolated, fragmented local issue, and really thinking about water risk as something that is systemic and that investors and banks should really be paying attention to.
What questions come to mind, Robin, when you hear Ambika's story? What would you like to ask her?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I'm curious to hear from Ambika. I know that you do have some experience as a banker. You know, what do you think it's going to take to get the banking sector really excited and energized about the questions that they're asking the potential folks they're lending to?
Yeah, I think for banks, I'd mentioned a little bit earlier, I think for banks, one of the biggest things that helps them move is understanding credit risk. So we use stranded assets, for example. In the climate discussion, we mentioned that was one of the big movers that got banks to act, was when we said, hey, coal is a stranded asset risk. You might, you know, not be able to use all the coal that you're financing 10 years from now, 5 years from now, because of regulatory risk. Now, if we could speak about water in the same language, talk about stranded assets, talk about drowning assets, drying assets. You know, these are things that banks are usually involved in for 10, 15 years when it comes to lending. They have a much longer term vision than politicians do, than governments do, than sometimes many other actors do, because they're in it for the long run. But if they understand that these assets may not exist, that a brewery, for example, when it's in the wrong location, may not be able to source any water and may not be able to actually produce anything that they're looking for, they might be tempted then to start doing a water risk analysis on that brewery before lending them the money. But at this point, it sounds very logical that this would happen. And I'm giving brewery because that is the most obvious example of water. Mm-hmm. But even there, it's just a checkbox. It's not something that bankers are really analyzing at this moment. So I think what would really get them moving is really understanding that water is a reputational risk. It can be a physical risk. It can be credit risk. It's a financial risk. It's not a non-financial risk.
Yeah, that raises the question, which role can the Valuing Water Initiative play for financiers, and how can they integrate these principles in their work? I would like to ask you, Preetha, about the opportunities and pitfalls. What are your thoughts about that? What will be the biggest opportunities around this sub-theme?
Yeah, I think the sectors that we're talking about here, like here now I'm talking about the banking sector, the finance sector, do not forget they wake up only for one reason as well. Yeah. So apart from making the money and making sure the investments are being set in the right places, they also wake up to compliance. Now, if you see there has been a shift in financing, now we're talking about ESG principles, we're talking about green finance, because there has been a shift in what your regulators and the finance regulator is asking you to do. So your compliance side of things. So once you start integrating water risk in terms of compliance, you're going to incentivize these banks and these financial institutions to actually lend the right way and actually do the in-depth analysis, risk analysis, like they do for a credit risk analysis, same thing for water. So so what we are starting to see in the I guess the water sector and the finance, water finance sector, is these champions, right? So there are a few champions out there who want to take the lead themselves. They're not triggered by compliance, they're not triggered by anything. You could say that back in the day it was under the CSR banner, but now it's going beyond CSR banner. So for example, we're working on an investment, it's a pilot investment in Vietnam, where they're producing clothing, denim clothing, for large retailers.
Yeah, the fashion industry. Exactly,
the fashion industry. So this particular manufacturer, beyond the request of their retailers, like the H&Ms or the Esprits of this world, saying that you need to sustainably, produce these garments, they've gone one step further, because they said that if they change their entire value chain sustainably, and water is their main focus of risk, they want to reduce their water footprint throughout the entire value chain. And at this point in time, what we are focusing is on the denim wash side, where about 65% of water is getting saved, and they're going to have zero discharge of chemicals into the ocean. So, I mean, into the environment. So in this particular case, they're just going one step forward than what the retailer is even asking, because what this actually does, it puts them in such a prime position for other retailers who are into fashion for good, now coming to them and crowding them and asking them to be the main producer. So they're able to monopolize some of that sector as well. So, but this is purely driven by the championship of that one particular manufacturer. He or she is not doing this because compliance is asking for. But I have to say, coming from a very conservative sector, both whether the water sector, even the water sector. So if you look at the public domain, or any user, a water service provider will not do anything extra unless the compliance of the regulation is asking for it. So there's no difference to the finance sector. So the work that, if you like to say, even what Robin, Ambika, and to a certain extent myself in that finance space is working, is to actually create these championships and incentivize why we need to do the right thing here. Because there's enough of data out there. There's enough of information out there to tell us today that, listen, if you don't do this in 15 years, 20 years, there is no investment in this particular country, in the case of a brewery, for example. So it's... unfortunately, we have to also work with practicality. So again, coming back to perhaps the earlier comment that even Ambika mentioned about having some of, like the Dutch Central Bank and the guys who are regulating this sector to start taking a stand and saying, listen, financiers, if you want to play in this field, you can only release funds if you've done the full assessment here for this particular sector. If it's a brewery, if you don't have the water sector risk analysis done and have monetized it, forget it. You shouldn't even go to credit for funding it.
We're approaching the end of part two. Thank you very much. We're going to take a quick break. More Water Talks on New Business Radio coming up.
Dit is New Business Radio.
Meer weten over onze programma's? Ga naar newbusinessradio.nl.